One of the tools I'm using for outreach is EvaBot. When I was thinking of who to invite as a guest to the SaaS Minds podcast, I tried my luck and pinged Jean-Baptiste, the founder of EvaBot, on LinkedIn. Super excited to have JB on this podcast with us today. JB operates in quite a competitive space, yet he managed to scale from 0 to 2 million ARR completely bootstrapped and became one of the leaders in the lead generation space. My name is Alexei, and I'll help B2B SaaS founders scale. We drop an episode interviewing up-and-coming SaaS founders once a week. This episode covers JB's journey from seeing the problem out there to building the product. It also touches on the recent rise of so many French founders in SaaS. So let's dive into the episode now. Hey, Jean-Baptiste. Super excited to have you here.
Thanks for having me, man.
Awesome. So before we start with really difficult questions, could you give us a bit of a background of your journey? You know, you did obviously a master's in entrepreneurship, but yeah, tell us a bit more.
So my name is JB. I am French. I'm plugging in my charger, sorry. I'm 29 years old. So, and I am the founder of EvaBot, which is a LinkedIn scraping tool. So I have a co-founder and we started like 3 years ago now. So first month we did like $46. Within 6 months we was at the 10,000 MRR. After another year we're like a 92,000, and now we are at $2 million. So $2 million in 2 years, only being like two co-founders. So a really small team. And yeah, B2B SaaS, so you can really grow with a small team, high margin, high MRR, just being like a few really skilled people.
Amazing. So
that's
amazing.
What I love about the SaaS business.
Cool. How do you split the work between you two?
So basically my co-founder is just handling all the deep tech part, like the extraction of data, the cleaning of data, and I'm handling all the acquisition and onboarding part. Like we identified two types of tech that needed to be built for SaaS business. And I think this is a framework that can be applied to any SaaS business. You get like the core value of your SaaS, and for us is the extraction of the data and the cleaning of data. And you get all that tech that you need to develop and which is like common to all the SaaS businesses, like the onboarding, the front end, the billing, the sign up, lost password, stuff like that. And I think that when you recruit, for example, a developer for a really complex product and you ask him to develop like lost password and sign up features, he can get bored, you know? Like the really good developers, they don't like to develop sign up forms, you know? They want to like develop like complex backend stuff, you know? And so we handle that with a no code tool, which is bubble.io. So I was handling that part, and now this part is delegated to a freelancer. But the thing is that with no code, the development of this kind of feature is like 4 times faster. So my tech founder is able to really focus on the core value of the product. And I am able, as a marketing guy, to be also in charge of the onboarding and the front end of the app, which is kind of part of the acquisition. And the other advantage of this is that it's made all the growth engineering parts way easier. Because for example, as a marketing guy, maybe you want to trigger something in a product to launch like onboarding sequences. And that's something we do and that work a lot at EvaBot is that, for example, if you sign up and you don't launch a first export with the tool, we will like put you in an automated sequence like, why did you not launch an export with the tool? And if you do launch an export with a tool, we'll put you in another sequence that will ask you if you're happy with the tool. So we use like triggers in the product to send messages at the right timing to people. And we have like insane reply rate on that, like 50% reply rate on LinkedIn.
Cool. Awesome. So before we dive deeper, maybe give us a quick introduction about EvaBot. I mean, we used EvaBot, still use it actually. But yeah, maybe tell us a bit more about what EvaBot is actually.
Yeah, it's kind of simple. Actually, it's a LinkedIn scraping tool focused on LinkedIn Sales Navigator. So Sales Navigator being the premium search engine of LinkedIn, which makes you able to make like really precise searches with really precise filters to find leads or candidates. And the problem that EvaBoot solves is that with Sales Navigator, you can't export leads natively. It means like you are making the searches, but you can like export the leads and put them in your CRM or your favorite outreach tool, for example. That's the first problem. Second problem is that the data is not clean. As you know, there are a lot of people putting rockets in their name nowadays. So you obviously don't want to put that in your CRM. Oh yeah, there's like naming capital letters or with typos, etc. And that's obviously something you don't want in your CRM or your call outreach sequences. So the data has to be clean, and we do that. And the third problem is that there are a lot of false positives in Sales Navigator search results. For example, you will like look for head of sales, and you will find head of talent in your search in your searches. So there are various reasons for that. I won't detail them right now, but EvaBoot handles these use cases. So with EvaBoot, in one click, you export your leads, you clean your leads, you filter your leads, and we also find the professional emails and verify them. So basically, the value proposition of the tool is to create a clean email list, ready for outreach email list, in one click from LinkedIn Sales Navigator.
Why would Microsoft not launch a feature like that themselves?
It's pretty complicated because it would be really hard for LinkedIn to tell their users that anyone can download their data at any time. Mm-hmm. You know, imagine Facebook saying that to all Facebook users that, by the way, anyone can download your data in a CSV file. So actually, in terms of GDPR, they can do that. So that's the B2C part, you know, of the problem. But there is the B2B part of the problem. So Sales Navigator, the competitors of Sales Navigator are companies like ZoomInfo, stuff like that. So ZoomInfo is actually the biggest competitor of Sales Navigator. And on ZoomInfo, you can search for leads and you can download the data. So that's make them way superior to Sales Navigator. So actually, Sales Navigator can't say, and LinkedIn can't say publicly that the data can be downloaded, but they need the data to be able to be downloaded to compete with ZoomInfo and other companies like that. So actually they need us. They need us to compete with ZoomInfo because they provide the data and they need other actors to make the download and to be able to compete. Because, you know, some people say that, aren't you afraid that LinkedIn closes your company and shut you down? And I say no, because they need us. Simply, they need us because if LinkedIn makes scraping possible, they will lose so many market shares for ZoomInfo and other competitors. And I think Sales Navigator is like more than 1 billion revenue for LinkedIn. And I can tell you, if they make scraping impossible, they will lose like 2/3 of that minimum.
Right. Yeah.
And they can't afford that.
Makes sense. So, and then obviously before EvaBoot, you did another business completely in a different space called Shambhala. What was, the lessons learned there? Was it the same co-founder, and how do you apply the lessons learned from then, back then to the new business now?
Yeah, interesting question. Funny thing is that first thing is that the Bubble guy I told you about that now is a freelancer for us is my previous co-founder.
Okay.
So that's the first thing. So you get like some butterfly effects a bit on your entrepreneurship journey, and that's why it's really important to start things because, Steve Jobs said like he was studying like calligraphy, and he didn't know why at the time. And that studies in calligraphy helped him design the fonts and for the Mac after that. And he says, get the belief that the dots will connect. The dots will connect. You do things and you have the confidence that the dots will connect later. And actually, so this is the first thing. Second thing is that I learned SEO doing Shambhala, the first company, which was an online therapy app. And I reused these skills for EvaBoot. And now SEO is our main acquisition channels that provides like 60 to 70% of the signups each week. So that's the two first things. And then with that company, we made like all the possible mistakes that first time founders could make. So we had a product in our head. We say like, this is the perfect product. So we don't need to talk to the users. let's just work in the garage for 6 months and release the product without talking to anyone to make a big launch. And that's actually the worst thing you can do. So the correct, and what we've done with Ibebuten, which is the correct way to launch a business, is to you don't build anything. You pretend that you have something and you try to sell it. So you try to sell something that doesn't exist. And that's what we've done with Ibeboot. We made a LinkedIn post pretending that the product existed. And we get like 100 calls with that LinkedIn post. So prior to building the products, we were able to talk to 100 people. And when you talk to 100 people before you build the product, obviously you're going to build the right product because you have like so much feedbacks, and the users, they tell you what to build. You don't even need to think about it, because the trap about like building a product like this is like you believe too much in yourself and in your vision, you know. Feel like, yeah, I have a vision for my market. And some founders, so in Kenwork, if you are like really part of your market, and if you have what I call the founder market fit, you know, for example, you are part of you are in a niche, you are working in a niche for like 10 years, and then you say, okay, now I know what product to launch. This is okay. But if you are like entering in a niche you don't know, you need to talk to 100 people minimum. And that's the number we had in mind. Mm-hmm. We said like, first we talk to 100 people and then we start building the product. And I think this is a good framework that you can apply to any SaaS business actually.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What was the post exactly? Do you remember?
So it was pretty simple. It was a description of the problem and then description of the solution, and say that if you want the solution, drop a comment. And at the time, it was like a pretty popular thing to do, you know, like drop a comment if you get access to this PDF, or drop a comment if you get access to this. It was really a good technique at the time, because that increased like virality, you know, because you got one comment. So LinkedIn show your post to more people, so you get more comment and you create a virality loop like that. And so I think the most important things is to really describe the problem really precisely and describe the pain. Because once people understand that you get their pain, this is the most important step. Because if they feel they really understand the problem, they will believe in you to build the right solution. And you create empathy. Okay, this guy, he knows what he's talking about. He knows about my pain and he knows about the problem. So I believe in him to build the right solution. More than the guy that don't know the problems and pretend to have like the best, like good looking with a really good design solution. Actually, people prefer really ugly products that solve the problem than a nice design that made by somebody that just entered the niche like 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I had another founder on the podcast. He was running Facebook ads to a landing page, pretending he has a product as well. And then he was actually doing all the things himself for every single person who converted. And then when he had 100 people, he then built the product to automate everything he was doing manually. But it was also...
That's like the best framework. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was also kind of like in a space, similar pricing to yours. So, you know, the concept of like, you know, hunting mice or hunting rabbits, which is kind of like, you know, the ARPA, I don't know, like between $100 a year to maybe $1,000 a year, right? I think if you're like SaaS enterprise, it might be a bit harder to do this way. But again, for you, it worked really well. Out of the 100... people you talked to, how many of them actually became then customers?
I don't remember well, because these were chaotic times, you know, you're like building the product, talking to a lot of people. So, but I think like maybe 10%, 10% conversion rate on these people, because the thing is that people tell you that if you buy this, if you build this, I will buy. And so you are building a product that you know that people will buy. You got like buying promises. So that's and so when you are building the product, you're not like just building the product and hoping that people will buy. You got like some people that told you that I will buy this if you do it. So, and that makes you in a really good mindset, because you know, like, once this product will get published, I already know that people will buy. So it gives you confidence in your developments and in mm-hmm. your work.
I've heard a lecture recently where one of the founders who built like 200 million ARR bootstrap business, he was saying you should even tell these potential customers to give you $50 or $100 and they will have like a year free subscription right down the line. Have you mm-hmm. done that, or were you thinking of doing it and then you just didn't do it? Or
this is a really interesting question, because for us, so we knew really well this lifetime deals platforms mm-hmm. like AppSumo, stuff like that. But this is a tricky question, because you underestimate with time the cost of the support that you will have with these people. So you got to really evaluate the situation, because, for example, let's say you are a new SaaS business and you don't know what your pricing will be, and you offer like a lot of lifetime deals to, for example, 100 people. And you completely underestimate the cost of support and the time you would spend with them. And so you have 100 people, and with these 100 people, you gain like 10K, you know. But for this 10K, you get like hours and hours of customer support you do every day for maybe several years, because it will stay customers, you know. So there is like a decision to make between cash right now and the cost of customer support you will have in your in future. And for example, now for us, we did a lifetime deal, but we did like secretly not on AppSumo, because it was like too famous, but we wanted to test the market, so we did it on another one, but we didn't advertise on it. It was kind of like a market test. And still today, you got people that get insane amount of credits, and they don't pay. And what they have right now is worth like several thousand dollars per month, and they have it for free. So, and we're like, and they ask for a lot of things, you know. So yeah, so you can do that, but be careful with the lifetime deals. It's better to do like 6 months, 3 months, or 1 year contract, like you said.
Got it.
Can be tricky with time.
Yeah, and you mentioned pricing, right? So how did you come up with the pricing you have right now?
I think this is the least documented topic on SaaS and on business in general, but like the most important. And all the companies are like, oh, let's see the competitors and put the same prices cheaper or a bit higher, you know. And this actually the scientific process we have right now. It's especially because we recently updated our pricing. And for me, there are two phases. So if you just built your company, you don't have data on your usage. So you have to come up with something. And usually you look at your competitors. But that can be tricky, because maybe you will underestimate yourself, because your proposition value is different. But it's honestly actually the easier way to go. You look at your competitors and you say, do we want to be cheaper, or do you want to aim for quality and be a bit more expensive? This is the first thing. A second thing is that you get imposter syndrome when you start as a first time entrepreneur. So you will always underestimate yourself and put the pricing too low. And that's why I said it was dangerous with the lifetime deal, because you underestimate yourself and the value of your product at the beginning, and you will put a lifetime deal price, and then with time you will gain confidence in your product and you will realize it has way more values than you think for first time entrepreneurs. So it's a bit of a chaotic process, but my take on that, it will be to constantly increase your pricing until people are mad, you know, and you must be ready to face anger. I think that's the best advice, because you want to test the limit of the people. For example, if someone is really upset that your product is too expensive because you created a frustration, and actually frustration is the best metric you can have, because frustration means people want something, but they can't get it. And actually, so frustration is a good metric for desire. You know, if you have frustration, you have desire. If you have no frustration, it means like maybe your pricing is too low or your value proposition is not sexy enough. Yeah. So I would advise to increase maybe at the beginning, you can increase every week and then try to reach the selling and see. And if some people are telling you like, I like your product, but it's a bit too expensive for me. I think this is the good pricing because you want to eliminate the bad clients because there will be people, they will only buy you because you're cheap. And you want people to buy your product because it's good and not because it's cheap. And we see that we recently increased our pricing and we use a different method because now we have a lot of data. We have a lot of usage data. So you can look at your usage and try to build clusters of clients. That's what we've done with data. So we look at the usage, we build clusters, and simply after that, the clusters are the different pricing plans. So it's way easier to build your pricing once you have data, but when you don't have data, it's a bit of a chaotic process.
Cool. Yeah, super interesting. All right, let's move on to the topic of growth. You mentioned 70% of your customers come from SEO. What was your first channel though, right? Because SEO takes time to build up, I guess. How did you, I guess, like start, maybe the 10 out of the 100 interviews you did, that were the first clients? Did you run any ads as well? Yeah, tell us a bit more about that.
So for me, you got three phases. So the first phase is like kind of the warm outreach phase. You will reach out to people you already know or people they are in your inner circle or friends of friends. And in that phase, you want to recruit beta testers, like test your product for free or give you feedback, stuff like that. And the goal of that phase is to develop an MVP and to get a first feeling of product market fit. And that's actually where you should get your first customers. You're like 0 to 10. Like we got lucky on the LinkedIn post because we get a lot of calls with people we didn't know. But if I had to start over, I will maybe talk to more people I know before that. And it was during COVID, so everybody was on LinkedIn all the time. So maybe that helped a bit. But first phase, warm outreach. And then you got like 0 to 10 clients, 10 clients with that, for example. Then you can start cold outreach. Because for SEO needs time, investment, and maybe money if you want to build links. So I wouldn't advise to start with SEO if you don't get the first feeling of product market fit before. And you want to start, especially in B2B, you want to start with a super efficient zero cost, almost zero cost acquisition channel, which is prospecting. So for me, you get 0 to 10 with warm outreach. And you should be able to get a strong feeling of product market fit with prospecting. You can, with B2B SaaS, get to maybe 10 to 50 clients with a warm outreach, with cold outreach. That's what we've done. So if I repeat from the beginning, it's like 0 to 10 warm outreach, 10 to 50 cold outreach to confirm your feeling of product market fit. And when you do outreach, you will start recognizing patterns and get a first idea of your personas. And when you get that, you can start to scale cold outreach, invest more, maybe recruit some SDRs, etc. Because obviously you have to do that all by yourself at the beginning to get the learnings and after that start delegating. And when we had this feeling of product market fit, we started SEO. And we noticed that we got a lot of transactional requests on Google for our product. For example, how to export leads from Sales Navigator, how to get emails from Sales Navigator, how to scrape LinkedIn. And we look at that and we're like, if you look for that in Google and you land on our website, there is a high chance you will sign up because there's a highly transactional request. Transactional meaning that you are really likely to buy or sign up for something when you write that. And once you get this feeling of product market fit, you can invest in more like demanding channels like SEO, YouTube. For example, YouTube is kind of, if you want to make a good YouTube channel, you got to invest in a mic, a camera, stuff like that, if you want to scale it. Obviously, you can start with like some, just like your computer, not such a good sound, not such a good video. to try. But that's what I would recommend, yeah, for business.
Yeah, you mentioned YouTube there. In fact, during our webinar on how SaaS businesses grow via YouTube, I actually showed your channel as an example. Yeah, tell us a bit more about YouTube. I think, obviously, you mentioned the founder of Lemlist, right? He's French as well. He used YouTube quite a lot as well. Yeah, like, tell us about the journey on YouTube, because I personally also invest a lot now in my YouTube channel, obviously also for New Optima, the agency, but, you know, also to build up like a personal brand. And I can see, you know, it takes, you know, months and months until you got views or a lot of views, right? So it's a bit of a, you know, leap of good faith there, right? Like, even way longer duration to see results than in SEO, for example. Right. So how do you approach YouTube?
So first, I would like recommend to every founder to launch a YouTube channel, because the era is everywhere. Like, because first, so first for SEO, for example, I will write an article on a specific keywords. The simple fact that I had a video to this article talking about the same topic will increase the dwell time on the page. And dwell time is one of the most important ranking factor for Google. So, for example, if I my dwell time without the video is 3 minutes, and if I add the YouTube video talking about the same topic, so I retain people that don't like to read and prefer videos, and I increase my dwell time on the page. So I use SEO to make more views on YouTube, and I use YouTube to increase my SEO rankings. And there is like a virtual cycle here. Second thing is that you build an emotional connection with your audience. And for products, and for B2B products, like, for example, data extraction, you don't get a lot of people with personal brands in the data extraction space. It's kind of a dark, you know, dark business, a lot of shady products. And the fact that you get a founder showing his face and showing out the product, how the product works, build confidence and trust in your brand. You differentiate from some other people. And third thing is that it's simply, it build brands, like you say, build your brand and your personal brand. And is this add side effect on all the steps of your conversion funnel? Because you get more sign up because you got a brand. Maybe you get more conversion because you got a brand and brand build confidence. And you mentioned that it's difficult to build a YouTube channel. I think the hack to bypass that is to realize that YouTube is a search engine. It's not only a virality, you know, doesn't only work, not only work with virality like TikTok, for example. You can actually search for keywords on YouTube, and it works exactly in the same way than Google search. So you can optimize your videos to reach for certain keywords. And that's how we build the channel. We're able to get our first 1,000 subscribers, is by targeting really specific keywords. And we use a tool which is called VidIQ, to estimate the number of searches on specific keywords, and then we build videos to target the specific keywords. And most of the time, the requests, search requests on YouTube and Google are the same. And let's not forget that Google owns YouTube. So right now, when you write something on Google search, you can see actually inside Google search results, YouTube videos. So actually, when you're making YouTube videos, you are ranking in the YouTube search engine, and you are also ranking on the Google search engine. So you multiply your views like that. So for me, it's simple. If you do SEO, you have to do YouTube, because they will create a virtual circle. And that's how you can, and the fact that you do SEO will help you to grow your YouTube channel, because people will write keywords in Google search. They will land on your articles. They will discover your YouTube channel like that, and they will subscribe. So you get YouTube subscribers with SEO.
No, absolutely. I mean, this is why we're doing it as well. It's just, yeah, there are so few people still doing it, right? Like, I mean, I guess like the number will increase over time. Now, moving on, in terms of your target market, it's still the English speaking world, right? I guess, you know, because of LinkedIn as well. Now you're based in France. Why have you not moved to the US? Because, you know, obviously the market is so much bigger there. Or don't you see a difference by being based in France?
So actually, the SaaS market is a SaaS business is US business. You know? It's like if you want to build a SaaS, you have to target the US because I can give you precise stats on that. Like 50% or 60% of our clients are from the US, and the rest and then it's like split between Europe and Asia, especially India, because Indians they do a lot of data extractions for the US people. And for the companies as well. And yeah, and France is 10, 15, yeah, 15% of our clients. So if we'd have done the business in French, we would have 15% of the MRR we have right now, you know? And I actually get mad at all the SaaS business, all the French SaaS business that's only communicate in French, because I'm like, you're dividing your market by 10. What are you doing? You know, just make everything in English. And with content, I mean, you don't need to be located in the US to target the US, because you can create content that ranks for English Google requests, YouTube English requests also. So actually, no need to move to the US, except if you have a sales team and maybe you need to network and meet people. But we are a self-service business, so we don't even do sales calls with people. So we already had people buying $2,000, $3,000 subscriptions without even talking to us. And that's the power of YouTube, because they see your face, so they are able to spend $2,000 on your product, because they know you are really a human being. You create content, you already help them. So you build this trust that you scale. The thing is that you scale trust with YouTube, because imagine someone that has like 1 million subscribers is scaling trust much faster than a guy that will like making calls with all like if you make calls with all your subscribers, for example, that will take like way too much time, you know. And YouTube helps you to scale that trust when you have self-service businesses. That helps a lot to get big payments without even doing calls with people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, one other reason to be in the US is, for example, if you want to fundraise, right? Obviously, it's easier there. There are more, you know, investors, high valuation, etc. So let's maybe touch on the point that you're bootstrapped, right? And you're super lean team, so, you know, highly profitable. Mm-hmm. Why did you go this way? Because you know that maybe the market, you know, is capped at some point. And, you know, you can just, you know, sell that business at some point, call it the first successful exit, and then move on to another one. Or do you think you can continue building out this business and still become whatever, 100 million ARR business, but going into like other areas as well?
To be honest, I think we didn't make that decision like on purpose, because we didn't have network. So if you had told me at this time, like, go raise fund, I would like, how can I do that? I have no network. I have no proof of concept. I have no value proposition. So how can I even do that? So that's the first thing. The second thing is like if you would have given me 5 million at the time, I would be like, I don't even know how to spend that, because I have no experience in the market. So for me, fundraise is a way to scale when you have a lot of data on your market, you have a lot of knowledge on which acquisition channel you would use. So actually, bootstrapping was not even a question for us, because we're like, because that was my second company, but for me, it's like the first one with not such a long experience. So I had no confidence in my entrepreneurship skills yet. So, and I think you need to go through this phase, or you put your hand in the dirt by yourself. And a lot of people, for example, they have like this amazing idea, this vision, and then they raise like 10, for example, $10 million, and they never get really close to their customers, because they're hiring customer support people, mm-hmm. they're hiring salespeople, they're hiring interns quickly, and they never really face the pain the user have, and they never develop this deep knowledge of the market. Because when you do everything by yourself at the beginning, you really build that specific knowledge that your users and your clients will really appreciate when they get on the call with you and when they talk with you on the customer support. So you get the client and users part, and then you get the delegation part. Because if you do everything by yourself when you start, delegating will be way more easier, and it will be way more easier to evaluate the people performance. For example, if you never do sales yourself and you got a sales guy, he got 5% conversion rate on his calls, and you don't even have a benchmark. If you don't know it yourself, you can say, I was at 30, man. What are you doing? If I was at 30, you can be at 32. So I only want people that are 30% conversion rate, because I was at that level, and I want to be the benchmark first. And then if I'm able to, if I got the skills, I want to build the benchmark and make myself the benchmark and say okay, I've done it, so you can do it now. Mm-hmm. And I would give you the content to do it, because I've been through this process, and I can teach you how to do it too. So delegating will be way easier. But for example, at the beginning, we had this period we're bootstrap, we'll never raise funds, we do everything by ourselves. But that changes with time, and you realize that money can be a way to scale. And once you really know your market and you know how to recruit talented people, money can be a way to accelerate that. For example, right now, I think we could raise funds, because if you gave me 5 million now, I will know what to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the really the big thing that changed.
Right.
Compared to the beginning phase, because mm-hmm. 5 million, I didn't know what to do with that, man.
So are you now open to fundraising? Do you have, let's say, a big enough product vision to say, okay, yeah, I can raise 5 million and then spend it? Or, because of course it will also come with a risk, right? You will have most likely a pref stack above you, and therefore you will need to exceed the valuation by multiple times in order to maybe make the same amount of money you can already do right now, right? If you exit right now to a PE fund or somebody else.
Mm. I think like everything, you get to do stuff to solve problems. So for me, fundraising, you fundraise to solve a problem, because you're blocked at a certain point of business, and you're like, how can we overcome this challenge? And fundraise appears like a solution to scale, But I feel like a lot of people raise funds for the sake of raising funds. And there is, let's not forget, I think there is a social aspect to it, because when you raise funds, your friends will, be proud of you. Your family will think that your business is working, but you're actually losing a lot of money every month. And people think that raising funds will make you an entrepreneur. For example, for us, our metric will be after 3 years of getting your hand in the dirt and really knowing your business, you can say, you are a true entrepreneur. If you you never done a business in your life, you got a friend who is a VC, and you raise funds after 2 months, and then you're saying you're an entrepreneur. There is a big difference between these two people in terms of really field experience. And a lot of people, they want to become entrepreneur real fast and say they are entrepreneur real fast, and they think that fundraising is a way to become an entrepreneur faster, But you can't escape the pain, man. you got to go through it and go through all the steps. And we call that get the scars. Get the scars. If you want to be a real warrior, you got to get the scars. And you can avoid that process. And buy this shiny armor, And you are not a knight because you have a shiny armor. You are a knight because you fought and you had scars.
Mm-hmm. This is a super interesting view. Do you hang out in entrepreneur founder communities in France, or how do you have this, let's say, wisdom? Obviously, you're super young still. You're not in the US where usually, the founder density, etc., is much higher. Or are you part of the French startup mafia?
So the thing is that the B2B SaaS business is quite developed in France. And I don't know why we get so much, I feel like a third of all the LinkedIn automation tools are made here. I don't know why actually we got this passion for automating or extracting data, But like, yeah, you got Lemlist, you got Wallaxy, you got a lot of email finders. Hunter, for example, is French as well. You got a lot of big SaaS tools in the B2B niche are made in France. So we got a really good community here. And for the networking part, actually, we changed our mind on that because our mindset at the beginning was networking is useless. We don't need that. We just need to work hard and to talk to our customers. Because between talking to your customers and talking to successful people at the beginning, you got to go with users because you don't even have product market fit yet. You don't have scaling problems. Your users will help you more than like the people you think are successful. And I think we made the right call on that. But now, for example, now our revenue is stagnating for like 6 months now. And we need some people insight because we are not able to find a solution ourselves. Maybe we are missing something, we are blind on something. So we started to reach out to people that have built bigger businesses than ours. And this is beginning to be helpful. And realize that the value of networking is really at that phase when you have project market fit, you are stagnating, you don't know why. And that's the right time to start networking and reach out to people because you don't know what you don't know. And sometimes with my co-founder Robin, we see a business and we're like, it's so obvious they should do that. But then you take a few steps back and you're like, some people are saying that about us. There is someone seeing us is like, and we're like, we don't know how to grow, man. You know? And he's like, it's obvious they should do that. But we don't realize that because we're blind. So networking and getting to like masterminds and stuff like that is a way to meet these people that we say, it's obvious you should do that. And you get to get closer to that people. So, and actually we subscribed to, we signed up to a mastermind like 2 weeks ago for that. With a French mastermind, yeah. But I guess, in the US, I think the offer of mastermind in networking is way higher than in France, I think.
Yeah, yeah, it's huge. I've been like part of two masterminds for the last 2 years. It's super useful. Yeah. All right, let's move on to the quick fire questions. So what's a book recommendation for SaaS founders?
I'm not a good guy for that because I don't read business books. I don't find them so useful at the time, to be honest. Now I'm starting to see the interest of it because we have like big problems, you know. I think the fact that a lot of people, they overconsume information before starting to their company. And let's not forget that reality is the best provider of information. Like, let's not forget that, you know. Like, if you want to get more data on something, like reality is a really good provider of that, you know, maybe better than the books. And for me, books, like now I started to inquire more on what books could I read on or how to scale, you know, how to recruit people. Because this is like it's something that you take a lot of time to learn if you do it by yourself. So you can actually save time when you read this kind of books. But me, the books I read at the time when I began was more like philosophy books. Like me, I'm a really big fan of Stoicism. So I'm a big fan of the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius. So that's a good one. I think Stoicism is a great philosophy when you are an entrepreneur. Like basically, if I sum it up, it's like know how to make the difference between what you control and what you can control. What you can control, you just shut up and adapt. So that's, you get that out of your mind. And what you can control, you have no excuse because you have control. So you just need to work more to have control on these things. And there will be a lot of pretty simple life lessons you can get from this book. And then I think another for people getting started, I think Atomic Habits is a great one because he tells you how to build a routine and the importance of what you think are small tasks, but actually a huge impact on your life, and realizing that the small stuff compounds and have a huge impact on your life. So that's a great one. But me, I prefer to like I just typed the name of the book in YouTube and I watched the summary of it.
Cool.
So
I actually
some great
just,
videos and I saved time with that.
That's cool. I just uploaded the best 10 books for SaaS founders literally a week ago. So yeah, check it out. Check it out. A lot of philosophy books there as well, by the way. Yeah. Very cool. What or who is an entrepreneur who you admire the most?
So I think I got several levels on that. In our niche, in the B2B SaaS business, I really like Guillaume Moubèche from Lemnest. I think he's doing a great work. He's also a B2B SaaS French business, so it's really easy for us to take that as a model. And then the other people I'm following are Alex Hormozi, obviously, he's doing like such a great job on simplifying like a lot of business concepts. And the good thing about Alex Hormozi is that you can listen to him when you're just getting started and when you are a really experienced entrepreneur. Like the content is really, a lot of topics are covered and he can actually, like, he follows you all along the way. When you're just getting started, when you get first customers, when you want to scale, he got content for all of that. Then you got Michael Siebel and Dalton Caldwell from Y Combinator. Great content if you want to like everything around finding product market fit and building an MVP. Y Combinator is really good at that. Like, you know, build something people want. That's their motto. And a bit more technical, Brian Balfour from ex-VP of HubSpot and founder of Reforge. Really great technical content and about growth and systems, how to build growth systems, and how to build a good funnel for your business. So yeah, that's the four people I'm following.
Amazing. What's the best piece of advice you've ever received?
I would say do one thing, do it every day, and do it for a long time. It's really simple. But actually, if you do that, like, there is no way you won't be successful. Because when you take all the people that are doing the same thing for 10 years, like 99% of them are successful in what they are doing. And there is like a huge correlation between simply the time you spend on something and the success you get with it. Like, it's so simple, but people, you know, often forget about that. It's like all the people, all the overnight successes, you know, when you dig a little bit, you realize that, okay, they are doing that for 10 years now. So it's all about, I think, making failure impossible. For example, if I tell you a story, I'm saying, man, I'm building the same SaaS since 10 years and I still got no clients. It's impossible. So if you put yourself in a setup where failure is impossible, you really increase your chances of success. So, and actually, yeah, pretty simple motto. Yeah. Same thing every day for a long time until it works.
Nice.
And that's what we've done and that's worked for us. So
yeah,
I guess that can work for some other people.
Okay, cool. And then the last one, who do you want to be on this? Who is a guest who you want to have on this podcast?
I would say Michael from Y Combinator, because a lot of interesting things to say, but he's not so much podcast with him. Maybe it's hard to get a bit.
It's probably very hard to get, but it's okay.
You will have to network, because Alex Hormozi, you already have tons of podcasts with him, so the offer is already, I think, met. But Michael and Dalton from Y Combinator, I think I would like if more podcasts with featuring them would be available online. I think that will be really useful for a lot of people.
We had the founder of Tiny Seed actually on the podcast. Was I think our seventh episode. That was cool as well. Obviously, yeah. Tiny Seed, not as famous as YC, but still a really good accelerator. And he's also not too often on other podcasts, so I felt quite honored to have him. Amazing.
I mean,
look,
these people, They see so many businesses failing, succeeding. They recognize patterns on businesses.
Absolutely.
And they're able to see like this will work, this won't work, because they have seen so much failures and successes in their life. They pretty good people to invite on podcasts, talk about entrepreneurship.
Look, it's been super interesting. Thank you so much again. And hope to see you another time.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. I'll be back when we are 10 million to tell you
good,
about the story.
Good. I hit you up. And, hopefully in, a year or two, actually.
Yeah, I hope so. Thanks, man.
Perfect.
It was a pleasure.
To finish off this episode, a little promotion from our end. Neoptima is an award-winning marketing agency for B2B SaaS businesses. We work with companies backed by YC, Sequoia, Carlyle, Lightspeed Ventures, Northzone, and many other top VCs and PE investors. We work with venture-backed, private equity-owned, and bootstrapped SaaS businesses all around the world. Reach out to us and book a call in the description below so we can optimize your growth journey. If you have a fellow founder, if you have a team member, if you are part of a Slack group, Telegram, or WhatsApp group with other founders that could get value from this episode, please share this episode with them. We want to help as many founders as possible to scale their business. Thank you for joining us on this journey. See you in the next episode.